From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato. But
Thanksgiving in Iraq. All hell breaks loose in Iowa. Plus, is the book dead? And why are Letterman's ratings rising? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum and our Santa Monica studio is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle and editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com, the 2007 Webby Award-winning best political website. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, columnist for the Washington Times and visiting senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Arianna Huffington is away today. A busy week. Also, since this is Thanksgiving week, it's time for ruminations that are not just hooked to the day's events, but we can broaden it out into broader and more thoughtful ruminations. Obviously, interesting news, Tony, I know that is of high interest to you. The news in the New York Times as we went to air this week that things looking up to some degree in Iraq. Tell us about the story and about what you make of it at this holiday season.
Well, it's a shocking story, appalling perhaps to some. It's above the fold in the New York Times on Tuesday this week, in which it talks about what seems to be peacefulness breaking out in Baghdad and Iraq, and it goes on. It does have its negative comments, but the shocking thing is that it, for the first time that I can remember, the New York Times describes an Iraq that may be moving towards a successful outcome rather than the picture that's been painted. The Washington Post had a similar article a few days before, and not related to that at all. I did a column last week on the same theme. And so it's too soon to tell, of course, but for the first time, really in probably 3 years, maybe since 2005, some people who are not simply neocon pro-war fanatics are beginning to think of the dreadful thought that we might be successful in Iraq. Bob. I use the word dreadful ironically, of course.
Of course, Bob.
Well, you've already been successful, Tony. You eliminated the weapons of mass destruction. You ended the ties to al-Qaeda, which after all was the excuse for this war. And now you are bragging about if we spend $191 billion on we can bring violence back to the level where it was last February. Unfortunately, Sunday was the most violent day in some time. And what the New York Times story was referring to is people being able to walk around the streets in some sections of Baghdad. This is hardly the liberation that was promised. It's also not true that the media has never celebrated the success before. There were those elections. In fact, the invasion was supported by virtually all of the mass media. And then there were the great coming together in the elections, the purple fingers, all those photos and so forth. And the sad thing, and I do say sad because I would like to see democracy flourish anywhere, including Iraq. But the sad thing is there has been no political resolution at all. And in fact, Iraq is being divided into bitterly opposite camps. And in the south, which we hardly ever hear about, the religious fanaticism of the Shiites is totally dominant, which was not the case even under Saddam Hussein, that you had people having to dress the way they do in the worst moments in Iran.
Bob, does that mean you see no progress from the surge at all, even in the way that some folks are saying, at least there seems to be some more security than there had been before?
I don't have any doubt. Anyone's seen the movie The Battle of Algiers knows, you know, the French, for instance, controlled Algiers and could stop silence. There's no question of violence. There's no question in Vietnam we had times when we could control the city. The real problem is I'll give you the estimate from the Joint Economic Committee of the Senate, which just came out, the majority, which just came out this weekend, said, I'll quote from it. It says, Maintaining post-surge troop levels in Iraq over the next 10 years would result in a cost of $4.5 trillion. Ron Paul came out with a statement yesterday saying that we've already spent $46,000 per American family of four, the equivalent in taxes in Iraq. So, yes, you could put in 1 million troops into Iraq. You've already driven 5 million people out of the country. It's not that big a country to begin with. We already have more troops there than we ever had in Vietnam as a proportion of the population. And I have no doubt that we could occupy, in the manner of the Romans, totally occupy Iraq. But I see no and by the way, I would love to take Tony's advice. I said this last week when he brought this up. I would love to say, yes, let's declare victory and get out. That's what you have to do. Yes, the situation is now stable. People are having weddings again. Let's leave. What I'm afraid of is that each glimmer of hope is going to be seized upon for extending the occupation. That's really what is at issue.
Tony, do you want to offer a last glass half full perspective before we move on?
Well, I mean, everyone is so polarized in their positions, but the fact is that we're seeing Sunnis send their sons into the army, an army that also has Shias in it. We're beginning to see a multi-sectarian army emerge. We're seeing the Shia extremists, at least for the time being, pausing, if not having laid down their arms. The Mahdi army is not marching. There are real signs of communities beginning to try to build order out of the chaos that has existed there for a long time. And those are all genuinely hopeful signs. Will it continue? Iran is said to be backing off some of their support for the bombing, according to our own generals. That's good news that Iran is pulled back. So I think there are a lot of good signs, and maybe next year will be the year when we'll decide that it has been a success. But it won't be a mere calling of it a success. We have to be honest whether it is or not.
But could I just make one little point here? When you say a success, okay, now, first of all, I mean, the reason for this invasion was supposed to find something that didn't exist. That was the reason. The American people, well, I'll give you one little statistic, okay? In order to finance the war in Iraq, we have spent an amount we could have covered every single American, 46 million uninsured Americans during that same time period. I dare say if you had said to the American public, Iraq war or cover every single American with health insurance. That's the figure, okay? I suspect they would have said, we'll take the health insurance. Last year, we spent more on the Iraq war, by far more, $50 billion more on Iraq than we did on all infrastructure, all NIH investment, all children health insurance, and about 17 other programs stuck in there. That's, again, the Joint Economic Committee report. So if you're going to talk about success, why don't you explain to the American public what you had in mind by success?
Well, let me respond just briefly, because your comment reminds me of what Oscar Wilde famously said of someone, that they knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. Look, of course, this has been every war is vastly expensive. Until you know the consequences played out through history, you don't know whether the money was worth spending or not worth spending. If, in fact, this turns out to be a process that begins to bring democracy to the Middle East, much scoffed at, but now perhaps a beginning of a possibility, then perhaps that'll be priced extraordinarily well spent. If it turns out to be a dead end, turning to a new dictatorship followed by suppression and resistance to the history of the Middle East, then the money will not have been well spent. But it's premature at this point to be cynical about the cost.
Can't we get a money back guarantee or something, Tony, from the Republican administration if we do this? We should move on. Obviously, we're going to be watching this. It's a good week with the holiday. In the holiday spirit, we can take stock of where the Democratic and Republican presidential campaigns are. Some news out of Iowa this week, where the action is really heating up. A new ABC News Washington Post poll showed that Obama had bumped up a little bit, so that he was actually in the lead. He was at 30%, Hillary at 26, and Edwards at 22. Lots of – and this is a sort of a plus-up of about 3 from Obama from the last poll they took. Lots of political insiders and experts on the ground saying these polls are largely meaningless. Even folks in the campaign say that they still think that the way the caucus going works, that as many as half the people are undecided essentially up till a day or two before they actually go huddle in their neighbors' homes and express their – expressed their preferences. Tony, as you look at the Democratic side, what do you see? What do you see emerging?
Well, although I completely agree with the proposition that Iowa polling weeks or months before have not been great indicators, I've also been in enough political campaigns to know that a poll like that can't help but be felt positively by the Obama people and with some nervousness by Hillary. Iowa isn't a must-win for Hillary, but it's close to it because she's trying to create the inevitable campaign. And Iowa is the one state where Obama's field staff are probably about as professional and effective as Hillary's. She's bringing in more people, more professionals to man the streets, the precincts. So I think we're seeing a very exciting contest in Iowa. I have no idea which way it's going to go. They've been getting more aggressive with each other. Bob Novak made a blind little observation in last weekend's column where he said agents of Clinton's are wandering around town saying that they've got something nasty on Obama, but they're not going to release it. Obama leaped up and attacked the Clintons for Bob Novak's characterization of what they were doing. They didn't quite 100% deny it, the Clinton team, but they sort of giggled and said that he was falling into a Republican ploy. It got pretty nasty, and for those of us who enjoy politics as a blood sport, particularly in the other party side, this was sort of fun this week.
And it was interesting on that Novak item, because at least I saw one clip where Novak said, because the Hillary people were trying to say, oh, this was Obama being naive and inexperienced falling for some Republican ploy because Novak's a conservative columnist. But Novak was very clear that the source of this was some highly placed Democrat who, I guess he said, was very close to the campaign, if not part of the campaign. Bob, did you follow this at all this week? Or where do you think this all stands? And is this scurrilousness? Are you pulling for Obama or Edwards to the throne?
I think it's important to have some serious debate about basically two matters in this election, and to the degree that it's a horse race, we'll get more of that. Hillary is vulnerable on one issue so far, which is the Iraq War, and all the polling data shows that what's causing her grief among Democrats who are going to vote is her waffling on the war, that she voted for it and really has never come to grips with it, and Obama has been tough on that. And it's interesting, in Iowa, according to the Washington Post ABC poll, Obama leads Hillary on women by 1 or 2 points. But nonetheless, I guess women care about war and peace and as well as gender issues. There's an issue that has not really come up in a big way, and I think is the deal breaker. I don't think this election is going to be decided on foreign policy. I think it's going to be decided on people losing their homes and where their retirement money is in terms of the value of the stock market. I felt the last election, that was a big factor in which commentators really didn't talk about very much, but the public was aware that the economy was in big trouble. And to have lost as much value in the stock market as we have seen in the last week, where it's incredible. And if that's where your retirement fund is, and you're, you know, whatever you're retired from, if you happen to have your money tied up in there, it matters a great deal to you if you're worth considerably less than you were a week before. And I think the issue of the housing market, they're now predicting it's going to go down 25% more over the next year. Well, for most people, their house is their retirement program. That's what they were thinking they would cash out on and go cruise somewhere or something. You don't have that. You're in big trouble. Now, Hillary's weakness, I think, is that she's been tied in very closely to banks, to the financial community. She's been a big fan of leaving them alone, deregulation and so forth. She's gotten an enormous amount of money. Her husband passed something called the Financial Services Modernization Act, which allowed the banks, the stockbrokers, and insurance companies to get together for the first time since the Depression. And I think a populist approach by somebody like Obama could have a real effect tying into this economic tragedy that's going on.
Up ahead, can Obama fight? Is the book dead? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Shearer is with me in Santa Monica. Tony Blankley in Washington on the right. We're talking about the Democratic presidential campaign. I tell you what has me, I've been in a funk this week. And I think it's because I've wanted Obama to come back and close the gap nationally and to make this a real fight, partly because I don't think Hillary gets tested otherwise, and partly because I don't find that she's as inspirational as Bill Clinton was back in 92 in ways that he always has had the potential to be. But the things that have frustrated me is, one, that he's not you don't see the signs of him fighting, I think, the way he needs to. Although one encouraging sign the other day was when she made a speech. Tony, I don't know if you noticed this. When she made the speech on her economic policy and said, for the middle class economic policy, and said, boy, one thing we need, said Hillary Clinton, is we can't have the next president, be someone who has to deal with on-the-job training when it comes to the economy. They need to be ready on day one. And Obama finally said, I'm not sure what she's talking about. I don't recall her being Secretary of the Treasury during the Clinton administration.
Yeah,
what experience are we talking about? No one talks about that.
Well, not no one, because I, in fact, wrote my column this week, which I had finished writing Monday before Obama had made that point, and that was my column theme. What in the world is she claiming that she has experience at managing a national economy? And I suggested that she release all the memoranda that she and her economic advisors wrote in 1993 and 2000 on managing the national economy. And if not, then I suggested the Washington Post do one of their famous in-depth studies of what she and her people were talking about during that time. Was she even claiming? I don't remember her claiming to be managing the economy. I think Obama had it exactly right. I was outraged that she keeps claiming that she has experience, as opposed to her policy. Her policy might be good or bad,
right,
but she doesn't have the experience. I think that's going to be a wonderful issue for Obama.
And I think that, it's funny because, I should have said, I meant the Democrats aren't raising that, and I've already sensed that. Somehow they're just, I don't know, they're too cowed to do this somehow, or they didn't want to go there for reasons that I don't understand, because it's clear that once you get to a general election, if it's Hillary, folks like you and the commentariat, and Giuliani had something that the Brian Williams and Tim Russert used in one of those debates. They had to use a Republican comment about this, where Giuliani said she's never run a city, she's never run a state, she's never run a business, she's never made a payroll. What are they talking about when they talk about her experience? And yet, until Obama made this, made this comment, which is, one little sentence, about 6 weeks out, it hasn't been coming up on this side. Bob, what do you make of the experience argument? Because I guess I think that's her biggest vulnerability, or one of her biggest vulnerabilities in the general election. And it's amazing to me that she's had a pass on it, essentially, in the Democratic primary. Maybe because her competitors aren't that experienced themselves, but they certainly have to try and go at her on this.
Well, I think experience is overrated. I mean, what usually they mean by experience is bringing the people who've robbed you in the private sector and then run the government sector, or people who've screwed up.
No,
on
they
the state
mean
government
you've
level.
Been a governor, you've been a,
yeah,
you know.
So, and look at what it did for George Bush, great leader. It just seems to me, I don't know, Hillary Clinton clearly has been around. She's clearly exudes competence. She knows what she's talking about. She was there, and she certainly was inside a presidency for 8 years in a very big way. And she's been around. So she's an experienced person. And, Obama has had less of that kind of experience. And, he's been a senator. So, I think she can claim to have been there. The real problem is...
Been there because she was a spouse of Bill Clinton.
I don't want to... As I say, I'm not that big on the credentialing here, because I say the people come in, they go into the Air Force being head of McDonnell Douglas, and they give away hundreds of billions of dollars and waste planes. I want to make a different point. I think, what interests are you serving? Who do you listen to? That's really how our government works now. Are you going to listen to people give you the big campaign contributions that have the big lobbies or not? Or are you going to care about the average person? A Democratic candidate, to my mind, has to break with the banks. Hillary Clinton once said, how can you be a lawyer and not work for the banks? That was before her husband got elected, when she was defending Whitewater and all that. And I really think what we need from the Democrats is a bit of what Ron Paul is providing on the Republican side, a bit of populism. And I don't mean just, Edwards does it a bit, and Kucinich, but I don't mean just, woe be the poor. I mean we've had the middle class been destroyed by is being destroyed by this administration, and the things that I just mentioned, the collapse of the housing market, the collapse of people's investment. This is very serious stuff. If you're approaching retirement age and you suddenly say, wait a minute, my monthly income in retirement is now going to be 20% or 30% less than I thought, that's a very big difference, and the Democrats better start speaking to that.
I want to, Tony, in one second, I want to get to the Republican side of this, but I don't want to leave the Democrats out. One other thought about Obama that's disappointing to me. I guess I had really hoped that he would be offering across the board solutions that were bigger and more equal to the size of our problems than we typically get in a campaign. And the Democrats have all aimed high on health care. And I think if a Democrat wins the presidency, which I hope, then I think the first term will be an effort to actually do some kind of systemic health reform where we make a real difference. But Obama put an education plan out this week, and if you care, as I do passionately, about the fact that we send the least qualified teachers in the country to the kids who need them most, and there are 10 million kids languishing in these high poverty schools, and it's going to take money as part of it. It's not just money, but until we make teaching something that actually pays as a career, we're never going to lure a better caliber college graduate to the nation's classrooms. And I was hoping that Obama would hit a home run on this somehow, and it looks to me, just looking at the details of what he put out, that it's between a single and a double, and that's depressing. Tony, did you want to share that depression or move on? Go ahead.
I know, I'm quite cheerful. Robert's comment about experience, I take it. I mean, Hoover in 32, Jimmy Carter in 80 had more experience than their challenges, FDR and Reagan. Experience is hardly everything. But the point is that Hillary is claiming experience, and it's the belief by the electorate, Democratic electorate, that she is a more experienced candidate that is giving her lift. So she's vulnerable on the charge of experience precisely because she's relying on, for her claim of experience, for so much of her support. But I take your point. I'd much rather have a brilliant, innovative person than someone who's experienced at failure.
I agree. And the reason I'm raising it is because if she's the one and she's going to emerge without having to deal in a sophisticated way with these arguments, then the general election is going to be very messy. You want to say something else on that before we move on?
No, I want to say about Obama that
I was calling on Bob. I'm sorry. Just quickly.
Oh.
No, go ahead.
Go to Obama.
I was just going to say, on Obama, I think your disappointment may be based on the fact that I think Obama specializes in a tone, in a manner, in a disposition, rather than a lot of a hard set of ideas. So I think he looks like the kind of guy you progressives would really like, but he doesn't have that much to say.
Let me disagree with that. I think were Obama to do the things you're asking him to do, he would have been laughed out of court. Oh, yeah, big program, big this, where are you going to get the money?
But they all went big on health care.
I understand, but what
you're— And that shows that the public's ready, I guess.
He clearly has a style that is, first of all, very reassuring to a large number of people, that he doesn't, shoot off his mouth, and he seems to be thoughtful. I think he's been very clear on something that matters a great deal to me. I would have trouble at this time supporting Hillary Clinton. I don't have with Obama. He's been very clear on the war. He's been very clear on why he would not have supported it. And I know this will sound like I'm harping on it, but you are not going to have the money to do what you want to do, Matt, when we are, according to the Joint Economic Committee report, going to be spending 10% of what the government takes in on servicing this additional debt. We're going to hear in the future years, when you want to pay school teachers more or you want to do any of these programs, we're going to find that we don't have the money.
I've written about that for years. We should talk about the Republican side briefly. I know, Tony, you were interested in the fact that Romney seemed to be accused of push-polling himself. What's that all about?
Well, National Review suggested, didn't have any proof, but they sort of wondered whether some push polling being asking sort of rude leading questions of respondents, is often used as a device to put out nasty rumors in the form of a poll, but in fact it's propaganda dissemination. And they wondered whether he was doing push polling on him and Mormonism on himself. Now, he is, as people have completely denied it, and I have no idea what the truth is, but it's fascinating that National Review, probably the leading conservative magazine in the country, would be sufficiently suspicious of Romney, who may well be our nominee, to accuse him of push-polling himself. It's just an interesting angle into what Republicans and conservatives think about their candidates this season.
It's funny. Just my favorite push poll I heard of this week was the John Edwards one, where I even heard some people saying that it was Edwards himself who was push polling himself to test his vulnerabilities. But the question was, you know, good evening to some nice Iowa household. Which would you find the bigger reason to vote against John Edwards? Is it that he's too liberal or that he ran for president while his wife was dying of cancer? You know, thank you for your comments and goodbye. So, Bob, anything briefly on the Republican side? Because we do want to move on to the death of the book.
Well, in the Republican side, I have a candidate, Ron Paul. And I'm not kidding. I just, you know, I have my disagreements.
I know you're not.
I have my disagreements with this guy. Obviously, I'm not a libertarian. But the fact is, if there's one person who out there who seems to be getting an audience, raising really serious questions about where do our tax—they are our tax dollars, you know. We can sit around on these shows and make all these jokes and everything, but the fact of the matter is there's an opportunity cost that economists talk about. You spend it one way, you don't get to spend it another way. And I'm really angry. And I'm glad that he is angry at one candidate that we have wasted trillions of dollars, trillions, you know. It's not chump change.
We're almost near the end of the show. I know, Bob, you have particular interest in raising the Amazon.com announced its digital book reader this week. It's on the cover of Newsweek, I think. Tell us, is the book dead? Is it being reinvented? Did Jeff Bezos not get the memo? Are we all going to be carrying digital books?
Well, first of all, the book is not dead, and it has not died. Book sales in Los Angeles, which are tops in the country now, are higher than ever. Books are doing very well.
We're both working on books, so we seem to believe in it.
Books are doing
Tony's
very well.
Tony's an author.
What has happened with Amazon, I think the stuff is great, and I happen to teach this at USC, so I care about it. But I think one of the great disappointments with the internet and with electronic media was the book reader. Microsoft failed. The digital book has not caught on. It's a really great idea, and Amazon seems to have solved the engineering and the communication problem with a gadget. I don't want to give them a big plug here, but a gadget that runs for 30 hours. You can download 200 books. You buy them for $9 a piece. There seem to be 4,000 books. All books are now in electronic form somewhere in order to be printed. And they claim you can download a book in a minute, and you're going to get on an airplane, and you don't lose it. You can erase these books. You can get them back. And it seems to me that that's a hell of a good way to read books without cutting down trees. And it's nice to know. And this is a print thing. It has nothing to do with other graphics. And I think it's a great sign for literacy.
This segment brought to you by Amazon.com. Tony, we only got about 20 seconds before we ran. Any thoughts on the digital book or any companies you'd like to plug?
I don't want to plug any books or any people, but I hope the book sustains, although I'm open to new technologies. I can't quite imagine carrying around a little screen for reading Dickens and Shakespeare, but maybe I will.
We will see. I still like to crumple up a magazine in the bathtub. I don't know if I can take my Amazon reader in there. We have reached that time once again for our famed end-of-show rant featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. We didn't get to the Letterman point, Tony, so not to give you offer a leading question, but it's your soapbox.
You know, this isn't a rant, but it is curious that with all the shows and reruns, Letterman is actually picking up audience while Leno has lost a million and Colbert has lost a stunning almost 600 thousand from a very low ceiling of 1.4 million. The question is why are Letterman's reruns doing better than the broadcast? I have no idea, but this is a deep truth about Hollywood, I guess.
Robert Scheer.
Well, I've been ranting all show about the cost of the military industrial complex, which is what my book is about. I just want to pick out one plane, the Joint Strike Fighter, which now they've gone from it costing $200 billion to $300 billion. This is a plane that was greenlit 6 weeks after 9/11. It has nothing to do with fighting terrorism, and now its estimated cost is $300 billion.
Well, if we're giving thanks, I guess even though I get disappointed and frustrated with campaigns, let's give thanks for democracy on this Thanksgiving show. And also thanks to a special feature that Time.com now has called The Page by Mark Halperin. If you are a political junkie, it's the place to go several times a day, I find, just to get the updates you need. That's all the update we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Sarah Spitz, our producer, with a big assistant today from Darby Maloney and J.C. Swadek, our technical director. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in after the holidays for another edition of Left, Right, and Center.
For more information about Left, Right, and Center, to hear previous broadcasts, or to subscribe to the podcast, visit kcrw.com/LRC. For questions and comments, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com.